Okay, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Chris MP as we talk about his thoughts beyond our future in space. I want to talk with him about the Big Bang when we come back, and then it'll be your turn. And welcome back, Chris MP with us. Chris, some scientists are now saying the Big Bang maybe never occurred, that the universe always was and always will be. What do you think of that?
Yeah, the Big Bang is, I like the fact that the Big Bang is a mature theory, 50 years old, is still under scrutiny. You know, scientists should never rest on their laurels. The basic evidence for the Big Bang, the microwave background radiation, the expansion of the universe, and the amount of helium we see, that hasn't gone away. But people are definitely looking at the model with fresh eyes. So there was some evidence of an early inflationary era, and that got a lot of news attention a year ago, and that evidence seems to have gone away. So, and that was fueling the idea of a multiverse, you know, many parallel universes out there. So that evidence isn't there. The idea of what the Big Bang emerged from, you know, what was the precursor state or what came before the Big Bang, that's still in play. I mean, basically the theory doesn't talk about that. So the possibility of eternal space-times from which our universe emerged, that's still a possibility that we have to try and test somehow.
It's just amazing, though. They talk about wormholes. They talk about dark matter. They talk about all these other things that are coming now into our forefront. Is it too much to comprehend, Chris?
Well, we certainly got some big holes in our knowledge. So, you know, as I'm sure you know, the universe, we're pretty confident we know what it contains, but the two things it contains most are dark energy and dark matter that really we don't understand very well at all. All the atoms and all the stars and galaxies are basically 4% of the universe, and the other 96% are these two entities, dark matter and dark energy, that we're struggling to understand. So, yeah, we've got some really huge questions to answer in cosmology.
Okay, let's take some calls now. The rest of the hour will go very fast. David is in Anchorage, Alaska, west of the Rockies. Hey, David, you'll be our first. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Yeah, I call in oftentimes about weird technologies. And years ago, so long ago, it was in a smoke-filled cafe for breakfast. So picture that in your head where you could still do that. I was talking to some guys about biotic technologies, and they introduced me to an older gentleman who was a neighbor theirs. They all knew him really well, and he worked on a lot of interesting things. And he mentioned that he test flew in different prototypes that he had worked on of flying craft. And I asked him how high he'd been up, and his highest altitude. I was thinking he was talking about airplanes, and he said 100 miles. And these guys didn't know what he was talking about. They didn't know what that meant, but of course that means he's been in outer space.
That's right.
And so I said, so you're an astronaut? And he said, he didn't say anything at that point. He just kind of shrugged his shoulders a little bit and looked sheepish. And his wife was sitting there with him, and then I started asking about the technologies, and he was working on, it was way before I'd found anything about this stuff, but he worked with a guy named Thomas Townsend Brown. He was a colleague of his, and they worked on anti-gravity craft, and I think it was through Hughes Aircraft.
And I know Boeing has been working on that, too.
Yes, and he actually said, yeah, Boeing has the same technology in the B-2. And I didn't know that either. I mean, I didn't know any of this. I spent a long time being able to actually track this down. This guy didn't even know how to turn on a computer. He was an old guy. And so there was no books on this stuff. He gave me all of this information that is played out on the internet now is being verified. And because I wrote it down. I sat there and I took notes while he was talking about it. And so anyway, he told me, and this was the first time I really heard of it, that we have had a secret space program, one that had been operating basically since the late 50s, early 60s, and that you know, it makes sense why there's a political aspect of this, and that's that Jimmy Carter, when he was running, when Ronald Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Carter was killing the B-1 program because he had the B-2 program. He had an anti-gravity craft being built in secret, and they wanted to kill a program that was basically early 50s technology, and because it was a waste of money. And the reason he lost interest in it was looked like he didn't like the military. But the fact was, we didn't need that because we had something better. And I think that same thing is playing out with nowadays, and that we don't have a lot of interest in the space program because the people really know that we have technology that's even better. And as far as this is something anybody can look up. There's a little piece of reef that's about 30, 40 miles south of Guam on Google Maps, which is blank. They have the entire ocean, the deepest parts of the Pacific, mapped out, but this area that's on a reef south of Guam is blank.
What do you think's going on there?
Well, that's where we have our space elevator, I believe. I know we have a space elevator. I know it's old technology at this point, and that we're ferrying stuff back up. And well, my friend Timothy Thrapp worked on it, and it bothered him a lot. He didn't like being that high up.
And all right. Well, let's get some reaction from you, Chris, on some of these things. I mean, do you think one, anti-gravity is available to us already?
So I do believe there are some clever technologies, some of which haven't necessarily seen the light of day. There are clearly, you know, classified programs of propulsion and spacecraft. But for anti-gravity, you're in the realm of physics, and that, you know, that's what I'm trained in. And so, you know, cheating gravity beyond a certain level is, you know, runs into obdurate physics, and also, you know, the physics community is a big community. There's 100,000 physicists worldwide, and many of them are working on engineering associated with physics that includes propulsion. So it would be very hard to have a true anti-gravity device developed in secret and in a lab somewhere that we don't know about, where none of that information, none of that potential, none of that possibility was known to this very large community of physicists and engineers who exchange information freely. It's just that I find hard to believe, just because it's not because you can't keep a secret. Yeah, clearly people can keep a secret. It's just because physics is not secret. And nothing in the textbooks I was raised with or the current version of the textbooks suggests you can literally cheat gravity. Now, you can do very clever things. You can have propulsion technologies and you know, air-breathing rockets that then move into the vacuum of space and become more efficient. And in fact, the Air Force, of course, had a competing program that was just sort of shelved when, you know, and in fact, many of the first formal astronauts were from Air Force test pilots who were just flying planes very high to the height that was alluded to in the question. So I do think there are clever and innovative technologies, not all of which have seen the light of day, but just flat out plain anti-gravity, cheating gravity, that's violating physics at a level I don't think can be demonstrated, because the community of physicists would just know about that. Otherwise, you're just sort of proving tens of thousands of physicists wrong if that's the case, which is possible, but I would say unlikely.
Existence of a secret space program.
And there could be a secret space program. Mm-hmm. My probably counter to this being completely under wraps was our earlier conversation about the Chinese emergence as a space power. I think, you know, if we were really in a mode where we were about to be eclipsed by the Chinese, which is probably the situation in the next decade, anything we just had under wraps would come out of wraps or would start being utilized very quickly, because I just don't believe there's any way the United States government would let the Chinese take the space frontier without, you know, serious competition from us. And so, you know, that will essentially, for me, that would flush out any technology that was being sort of kept under wraps, because at that point we would absolutely need it just to preserve our status and power in space.
And his thoughts that we already have a space elevator.
Well, that, again, is possible, but it's subject to evidence. I mean, a space elevator is you know, it's such a huge, even though it's a slender cable, it's a huge, long cable extending out into space, basically to the geostationary point. So hiding something like that is extremely difficult. We've got, you know, hundreds of Earth-looking satellites, small, large, and medium, that are imaging things down to the size of a smartphone, and commercial ones that are boulder sized. So it's really too hard to hide something that physically big. You can hide small stuff, but you can't hide a space elevator, because it's going to be stringing up from some point on the Earth's surface way out into Earth orbit. So I just don't believe you could hide something like that. There's too many. There's thousands of Earth-looking devices now imaging every part of the planet. There's no part that isn't imaged.
Let's go to Rick in Chattanooga, Tennessee, now east of the Rockies. Hi, Rick. Go ahead.
Hello, George, and hello, Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
I will try to be concise. Space elevator to me is just ridiculous. It's obsolete to begin with, but I'm not a very intelligent person when it comes to all those things, but I've listened to you a long time. And I work for AT&T, and I work in the electronics part. And what's happened here in the last 3 years is just absolutely unbelievable. And what I don't understand, I think the service died more than once, no question. And if people don't think there's other intelligent life out there, to me, that's ridiculous. But you boil it down to its essence, and you come down to one thing. Where did it all start? And there's just no answer for that. And I just think that the technology is so far past us, what we know, but they know, that they're just giving it to us a little bit at a time. And I don't know if any of that made sense, but I sure like listening to y'all, and thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Rick. And he has a perplexing question there, Chris, and that is, where did it all start? I mean, somewhere, someplace, there had to have been a beginning. My mind just can't comprehend something coming from nothing. The Big Bang doesn't make sense to me. And something that was always here doesn't make sense to me. So it's puzzling.
Yeah, so the Big Bang does not talk about really where it all truly came from. The Big Bang, you know, if scientists are being honest about the limitations of the theory, the Big Bang is essentially a description of the universe as it evolved from a very hot, dense state 13.8 billion years ago. And in those terms, without speculating as to where it all came from. And then in those terms, you know, the theory has some predictions and explanations. It talks about how the universe got bigger and cooler, and how gravity gradually formed stars and galaxies, and then within those stellar systems you can have planets forming, and so you can do simulations and models with computers of how gravity might form all the structures of the universe starting from this hot, dense, smooth state. And so in that sense we sort of understand how the universe evolved and got structure. Now, we don't know down to the detail level, so nobody has ever simulated how life started. That's a huge question. We think it happened on the Earth naturally without any divine intervention or supernatural phenomena about 4 billion years ago, but nobody knows. Nobody was here to record it. There's no evidence. There's almost no evidence surviving from 4 billion years on the Earth, because the Earth is such an active planet. And so the question of how life evolved and emerged is still a big unanswered question in science.
We go now to Frank in New York City. Hey, Frank, thanks for calling, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Isaiah Kessler. I forgot the name. I'm sorry.
That's
yeah, I just want to relate an experience I had, and also two questions. I'll try to make them quick.
Sure.
In the past, I had bad experience when I was incarcerated, and I started to think that I felt bad about my situation. Write to NASA, and they could use me to go out into space and go somewhere to some planet that other astronauts haven't been to, or go beyond the solar system. So anyway, when I got free or whatever, my brother told me there was a Mars One program, and I thought it was kind of a strange thing that I thought about that, and this program came about. Anyway, I just have a question for your guests. If a ship goes real fast in space, isn't it going to turn to ice? like the whole ship is going to turn to ice ball because it's kind of cold in space? That's one question. One, and two, if we go so far, aren't we going to exhaust all the resources on Earth to travel out there? And I'm going to get off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, good question. So you're absolutely right. Space is fantastically cold and dangerously cold, and so, you know, the space environment is intolerable to humans, and even keeping a spacecraft warm requires energy. So basically all spacecraft with humans on them, or even just with instruments on them, will need to use solar panels to grab sun's radiation and turn it into heat to keep those, you know, instruments working or to keep those humans alive. So absolutely right. It's incredibly cold in space, and that's an issue. You just have to use available energy from the sun to heat the heat things. I forget what the second question was.
Well, he was talking primarily about just all things in space. And
yeah. He also mentioned Mars One, which is interesting. And there, you know, what would you think about? So, you know, we just had a caller who was considering signing on to the one-way trip to Mars. You know, that's a very adventurous spirit. Anyone who would imagine going to another world and dying there, living and dying there, you know, that's amazing. I'm kind of intrigued that one of your callers has said that, because I don't think I would do that. You know, I'd love to have a joyride in space. I might go up in a Richard Branson special if I had a spare $250,000, which I don't. But the business of going to Mars on a one-way trip, I'm not brave enough to do that. So I was interested to hear you have a caller who thought about that.
In your opinion, how did it all start?
You mean the universe or the biology part?
The universe.
The universe. So I'm, you know, an adherent of the Big Bang model as much as I, as well as it's been developed, because I see the evidence for an early, hot, dense phase of the universe, and I think it's fairly convincing. But as for where it came from, you know, was it some huge free lunch from a quantum fluctuation, which is what some theorists would say, or is it part of some eternal landscape where, you know, universes are coming and going all the time, and we just happen to be riding one expanding bubble of space-time that we call our universe, and there are others out there, and maybe ours will eventually dissipate. That's interesting, too, and that's another theoretical idea, and I don't know if that's right. So, unfortunately, you know, science theories have their limits, and the Big Bang is a nice description, physical description of what happens to the universe from an early hot dense phase, but it's kind of mute as to the cause, the origin, which is interesting because it opens up all sorts of possibilities. I mean, it means people are free to speculate.
All right, we're coming back in a moment on Coast to Coast AL. On our next Coast to Coast program, Gary Grossman joins us. He is a journalist and a very successful television producer out in the Hollywood area, as he talks about the paranormal and UFOs and the occult. That'll be our next Coast to Coast show. Welcome back to Coast, final segment here with Chris Impey and your phone calls as well. Chris, why don't we know as much as we should about the universe?
Well, you know, it's big. That's the simplest question. The simplest part of the answer is that it's big. The distance to the nearest star compared to the distance, say, to Mars, is factors of hundreds of thousands, and that's just the nearest star. So even our own galaxy is huge. So, you know, the information we have to gather from these remote locations is traveling an awful long way, and it means we're looking back in time as well as out in space. And really only a handful of facilities like Hubble Space Telescope or our big ground-based telescopes can gather that kind of feeble light from so far away. So it's just hard as part of the answer, because the universe is big. And also because the problems, having a basic description of the universe and having laws of physics and a law of gravity that work pretty well, the problems we're up against are getting to be kind of thorny, like the dark energy and dark matter issues I mentioned earlier, or the fundamental nature of matter, which is leading physicists towards string theory, which is a difficult problem to solve. So we're running into some very tough, thorny, fundamental science issues to make progress.
Will we ever get the answers we want to find?
Well, you know, it's job security for scientists if we don't get all the answers. You know, I'm out of a job if we know everything. So, you know, we got to be careful of that.
All right, let's go back to the final calls now. Let's go to Keith in Rochester, New York. Hi, Keith. Go ahead, sir.
Yes. Mr. Impey, I have two questions. Is your work in astronomy showing that the Earth is changing in any way dramatically? And if so, would that spur on space exploration? Secondly, the Chinese have cornered the market on rare earth materials. Many Americans would be surprised to what degree they have. Would they ever cut us off from those resources? In their recent feud with Japan, the Chinese denied them rare earth materials for 42 days. Thank you.
Yeah, good question. So as far as the Earth changing, my astronomy research is mostly outward-looking, but I'm aware of the downward-looking research. NASA, for instance, spends over $1 billion of its budget each year on downward-looking, Earth-looking satellites and Earth investigation and remote sensing. So we have a lot of data on how the Earth is changing, and it is changing in various ways, obviously industrialization and so on. And how does that relate to space travel? Well, I think it's very relevant because as our planet changes, you know, some of it due to our own industry, we may have to learn to live in a more difficult world. And learning how to live on the moon or Mars and live off, you know, in these brutal environments is extremely good training for living in harsh environments on the Earth and be very efficient in our use of resources and energy. So, you know, space travel and space colonization is a stretch goal that has its own value, but it also has value in terms of how we live on this planet. On the other issue, absolutely, rare earths are precious commodities. Our industry and huge commercial activity depends on the availability of that resource, and they do for just geological reasons. The Chinese have a lot of those resources, and a lot of the rest of those resources are in kind of countries of dubious stability in Africa and elsewhere, or countries that we're not on good terms with. So that's a genuine concern. I would say, however, that the mining companies are, you know, part of the solution to this, because they're busy finding new resources for rare earths that are in more friendly countries or in places that we already do business with. They haven't solved that problem, but there's obviously a strong motivation to do that. Now, the space solution to that problem, of course, is hypothesized to be mining asteroids, and we're decades away, I'd say 2 decades away, from lassoing an asteroid, whether it's a government or a commercial entity trying to make money, and providing a sort of almost infinite resource of rare earth and precious metals that we can just harvest and then bring down to the Earth. So you're right, it is a sort of small crisis at the moment, the availability of rare earths, but there's sufficient motivation to solve that problem, and geology, luckily, is helping us because we're finding new sources for those special materials that our industry depends on, and some of those new resources are in places where we do have access to them.
Ever meet Stephen Hawking?
I have once, when I was a young grad student, actually, and he was a young professor, and, you know, he's an amazing character. He's a rock star of physics, if you like.
All right, let's go next to Karen, Long Island, New York. Hi, Karen. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Jared. I've listened to you for years. Thank you for taking my call. I just haven't, you know, you mentioned about how it all started, like the Big Bang, but, you know, where did it come from? And when I first heard of the Big Bang and they talked about going to the singularity, I kind of, because we think of God as being one, I thought of it as God exploding himself or part of himself in order to create the universe. And that's just something that I've always thought, like, it's kind of gone to the back of my mind, but I just throw it out there. It's not really a question, it's just, you know, I do have a question for your guest about, I kind of wonder that, you know, they go out in space and they talk about dark matter, like, wouldn't the spacecraft maybe crash into it or something? Like, we have the Voyager out there and so forth, it's never crashed into anything. Like, you think of matter as being a material type of thing. That's all I have to say.
So that is
okay.
A good question.
Go ahead,
because
Chris.
Dark matter is ubiquitous, and astronomers think there's 6 times as much dark matter as all the normal atoms, protons, electrons, and neutrons that we're made of. So that's an absolute fair question and concern of what's going on with that dark matter, and if you run into it with a spacecraft or humans go out there, is it a problem? And it isn't, for an interesting reason. The dark matter, we think, is a fundamental particle, so, you know, something like a proton or a neutron, but more massive, but also a particle that has mass but doesn't interact with other particles very easily at all and doesn't interact with radiation. So the dark matter, it doesn't collide. It has mass, but it actually has a very small collision cross-section or interaction, and that means it actually is not dangerous. So even though the dark matter is ubiquitous, and we think it fills intergalactic space, the vacuum of space, it's not something that you'll run into and have a problem with a spacecraft. Now, the flip side of that is on Earth, when we're trying to detect dark matter in the Earth or near the Earth with a physics experiment, it's really hard to do. The dark matter interacts so feebly with other matter that physicists are having a really hard job designing a lab experiment to detect it. So the thing that makes it good for a spacecraft not running into the dark matter makes it hard for the physicists who are trying to detect it and figure out what it is on the Earth.
What do you think of the multiverse theory, Chris?
Well, it's we talked a little bit about the basis for that before, which is that the universe in the Big Bang model appears to have emerged from something that was quantum-sized space-time event. And it's that notion, the idea that the universe was a sort of quantum event in the beginning, and since quantum events in the microscopic world are sort of random fluctuations, you can then hypothesize that whatever the basis for the Big Bang event was, there may have been other events, other space-time events, other quantum fluctuations. And that, in simple terms, is the multiverse idea, that our universe, our big, old, expanding universe, is just one of these space-time events from quantum fluctuations. And the others might have different properties. They might not be like our universe at all. They might be bigger, they might be smaller, they might have lots of antimatter in them, they might have different laws of physics, and that sort of diversity of possible universes emerging from the situation where the Big Bang started is the multiverse idea. As for testing it, boy, that's really hard, because you'd have to detect some of these other universes, which are sort of parallel universes. They're not interacting with ours, they don't intersect with ours. Clever physicists are busy working on ways you might detect very subtle signatures of these other universes out there, the multiverse idea, but nobody's come up with a test that you can do. So physicists are intrigued by the idea, but at the moment it's not testable.
So let me ask you this. What do you think of the possibility that when we find out exactly what multiverses might be, that it will literally change the face of physics that we understand today?
That's absolutely right, because in the multiverse notion, these other universes are going to have different laws of physics. I mean, their physics will literally be different. They won't have the same four fundamental forces that we do, for instance. Their particles may be different. The way the radiation behaves may be different. So, absolutely right. I mean, if the multiverse is true and we can demonstrate it, it rewrites physics. It sort of writes a bigger book of physics beyond the little book that we have in our universe. That would be incredibly exciting.
Sure would. Mike in Montreal, International Line. Michael, you're up with us.
Thanks for having me again, George. Nice
sure,
to
Mike.
Talk to you.
Hi.
Okay, I wanted to talk about some of the discoveries at the Large Hadron Collider, you know, CERN. The major one being, of course, the God particle, or I guess the Higgs field in itself, you know, the Higgs boson plus the Higgs field. They're running this year at even higher power, at double power, and they may make great discoveries, including other dimensions. The thing I wanted to talk about is the way we're talking about space exploration at this point. You're saying it's a 50-year-old technology, but it's really a 1,000-year-old technology. The Chinese were using rockets eons ago. You know, rocket technology is really not the way to go. One of the biggest barriers to putting in the space elevator is just the mass of the cable that goes out there. To build the cable strong enough, it would be so heavy that it would fall down. However, with the Higgs boson and being able to turn off the Higgs boson, which we'll ultimately be able to do, we'd be easily able to build the space elevator and easily travel to space by eliminating mass. What do you think about the advantages of the Large Hadron, what the Hadron Collider's found already, and some of the things it may find this year?
Well, that would be great. I mean, the possibility you're raising is fascinating. So it's really early days for that kind of physics. So the Higgs field, the particle, was discovered just a couple of years ago, and we know very little about it. Basically, we just know its mass or energy and almost nothing else about it. The LHC, the Large Hadron Collider, coming back with higher energy, is really going to sort of bear down on the Higgs and try and learn more about it. And those will be steps along the road to what you're talking about. And I like the gist of your question, because you're alluding to the fact that the Higgs field or the Higgs particle is the mechanism by which mass is established in the universe. It's the mechanism that gives the mass to electrons and protons and neutrons and us and planets and space elevators and anything. And if we could control or harness that field or that force or that mechanism, then indeed that implies control over mass, which would be extraordinary. So I guess, so I like the question, because I understand what you're inferring by it. But what I would just say is, unfortunately, it's just infancy of this field. We barely discovered the Higgs. We barely know anything about it. And we certainly don't know enough about it to control it or to turn it on like a switch on and off and have mass at our fingertips. But if we did, yeah, that's a total game changer. And it's a good motivation, I would say, to keep doing those physics experiments and try and find more about the Higgs. And for the LHC is the only game in town, really, for that. It's the biggest accelerator in the world, the only accelerator that can study the Higgs in detail. So we're all going to just sit back and see what it does in the next couple of years.
And you think that money is well worth how much it costs?
Yeah, that's a hard call. You know, we have problems on Earth, and I have debates with my friends in other disciplines who are not bought into science at the level that I am. It's very expensive, the Higgs or the Large Hadron Collider, and it's European government sharing the cost. I think, you know, in the totality of the money we spend on science worldwide, it's money worth well spent. It's worth it. But you know, we can't spend much more than we already are. For instance, the physicists contemplating the next biggest accelerator, you know, after the LHC, what do? They basically have decided they can't afford the next biggest one. The next bigger accelerator is going to be more expense than their budgets all put together worldwide. So, unfortunately, physics is running into some serious barriers of money and resources as far as doing something better than the LHC.
All right, next up, we go to Charles in North Carolina. Charles, thank you, sir. You're up.
Hey, how are you, Chris and George?
Good, Charles. Good. Thank you.
I just wanted to reference the Chinese Lunar Program that you guys were talking about earlier. And the most interesting thing is what I didn't hear in the conversation, which was the fact that there's a very explicit intent by the Chinese space program to harvest the moon or mine it for helium-3, a rare isotope. I'm sure, Chris, you know what that is. To use in their fusion program, which they are, it seems, you know, really, you know, focused on doing on Earth. And, you know, what, if any, you know, prospects do you think that would mean for humans here on Earth and in space in regards to fusion and their space program?
Right. So helium-3, as you correctly point out, is a key element in any kind of fusion program for peaceful purposes, let's assume. And it's a very rare commodity. It's a very rare resource on the Earth. And it turns out not to be as rare on the moon for various reasons, basically because the moon has no atmosphere and cosmic rays are pounding the moon all the time. And they just create a larger amount of helium-3 near the moon's surface than we would ever see on the Earth. So there's a fair amount of helium-3 on the moon. And the idea is, if you could just get it back to the Earth, that's an extremely valuable resource, and you couldn't get it anywhere else. So I'm sure is part of the Chinese long-range thinking, but we are talking about long-range thinking, because gathering, harvesting, and transporting helium-3 from the moon requires not just your first moon base. It requires a pretty robust lunar colony and some serious infrastructure on the moon, some serious industrial infrastructure to get that back. So if we just play out the most aggressive time scale that the Chinese have for a lunar base, maybe 10 years from now, you're still talking 20, 30, maybe even more years before they have enough infrastructure on the moon to truly mine, harvest, and bring back helium-3. So This is not an urgent concern. I mean, if we're worried about that resource and getting our own version of it or bringing it back, we have a few. We have at least, I think, 3 decades to work with.
Well, Chris, what is, with a minute left, the most compelling area that we will go into in the next few years?
In space?
Yeah.
Oh, I think, you know, I actually will not pick Mars because that's the obvious choice, and we're spending plenty of time on Mars. I think the place we want to go back to is Titan, a moon of Saturn that has these liquid ethane-methane oceans, and if there was life on Titan, it would be a different form of life. We were talking about forms of life earlier and whether biology on Earth is unique or special. So there, right there in the outer solar system, is this amazing moon with a thick nitrogen atmosphere, thicker than the air we breathe, and it has liquids on its surface, and we barely know anything about it. And that would be an incredible place to go back to.
All right, my friend. Thank you, Chris Impey. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Burleson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.